Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, William Galston of the Wall Street Journal and the Brookings Institution, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Professor Nicholas Grossman. He teaches international affairs at the University of Illinois, and he is a senior editor of ARC Digital. Welcome, one and all. Well, I'd like to begin this week with a discussion about the campaign that we've been seeing. And I want to play a short clip from one of Donald Trump's, well, the only rally that he did this week. This is from Ohio.
Please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages.
You see the spirit from the hostages, and that's what they are, as hostages. The first day we get into office, we're going to save our country, and we're going to work with the people to treat those unbelievable patriots.
Unbelievable patriots, Linda. Now, this was one of the more obvious, outrageous things that Trump said during the rally. There were many others that he has said during the course of the week, and yet we found ourselves wrapped around the axle over the one word that he used, namely bloodbath. Well, what did you think of, first of all, the way he is introducing his rallies now? By the way, obviously, that was written by none other than Donald Trump himself. The horribly unfairly treated, I mean, anyway.
And you can't imagine him sitting at a computer and writing anything. So I guess it's a speech to writing, using some AI to turn his crazy, you know, long meandering speeches into text. Look, I think it was a horrifying spectacle. If I had every reason in the world to vote for Donald Trump, which of course I don't, but if I did, and I saw and heard that, I would turn around and change my mind. I mean, we are talking about a man who is elevating convicted criminals, people who have broken criminal laws and are serving sentences for having beaten police, for having taken police weapons and used them against them, for having bear sprayed the faces of police, leading not only to injuries, but at least in terms of one of the officers present, may have led to a stroke which caused his death the next day. This was horrifying. Talk about the rule of law. I mean, it sows such disrespect for our judicial system. These are people who were tried, for the most part, some of them had plea deals, but the people who were actually in jail, most of them were tried by juries of their peers. And they are serving their sentences because what they did was not just a physical assault on the U.S. Capitol. It was an assault on the Constitution, assault on our way of life. And to elevate these people, to call them patriots, is terrible. As for the bloodbath, if he doesn't win, I mean, this notion that that was only referring to, oh, a bloodbath in Detroit, in the auto industry, it's going to mean, you know, that if Trump is not elected, we're going to be able to buy Toyotas and Hondas and lots of other kinds of vehicles and pay a market price for them.
As opposed to the 100% tariff that Trump proposes.
Right, opposed to the 100% tariff. I mean, he's going to double the price of automobiles that are popular in the United States. By the way, these are automobiles that have plants in the United States. They may have some of the work done in a place like Mexico and have some then shipped into the United States. But this is really crazy. And there's no question that that term bloodbath was much broader than what would occur in Detroit in the auto industry if we had Joe Biden reelected. He's talking about, particularly since it falls right in the, you know, right after, you know, this invoking of patriots who stormed the Capitol. He's talking about a hot civil war. You know, maybe it'll only be a guerrilla war. Maybe it'll only be a few thousand people. But this, he's talking about blood in the streets. This is horrifying. It is disqualifying. I don't know how any right-thinking individual who believes in the rule of law could support this man after that speech.
Nick, some people say, well, hang on. He was clearly talking about the auto industry. He frequently is kind of incoherent in the way he strings words together. Yes, he did say, oh, it'll be a bloodbath, and that'll be the least of it, which tends to suggest that he meant a broader outbreak of violence than just a metaphor about the auto industry. But because it was ambiguous, it gave the Trump explainers the opportunity to jump in and say, you see, they're distorting what he said, they're misrepresenting him. Therefore, respond to this, if you will, it was unwise to focus so much fire on that one little phrase when there is a cornucopia of things that he has said and done just in 1 week that should alarm and horrify any right-thinking person. Your view.
Right. I think the important thing is the larger context that people tend to get maybe wrapped around a single word. And this is partially a trick that apologists and defenders like to do of it seemed almost like we're standing in front of this burning forest and arguing over whether one tree's bark is properly described as tan or brown. It's, you know, okay, maybe we can debate that, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that the whole forest is on fire. And Trump has stoked and encouraged political violence since he first came on the scene in 2015, when he started running for office, with things like encouraging people to beat up protesters, to be violent against journalists, to promising, oh, if you get too rough, I'll pay your legal bills. Mm-hmm. And that is so encouraging people to be violent. And with the opening with that, January 6th, with defending the January 6th attackers, is much more serious than the bloodbath thing alone. And when you put them in context, I've heard, of course, bloodbath as we're going to lose a lot of money. You know, the industry will be wiped out or something like that. And you know what? Fine. So let's be really generous and say it was totally and entirely about economics, nothing else. So what? There is so much else that is threatening violence. And the action of offering in particular to pardon the seditionists and the insurrectionists and the people who were convicted of assaulting police officers and other serious felonies, that by promising to pardon them, what that is a signal that they should be lawbreaking, potentially violent on behalf of Trump, and then he will protect them. And it's a similar signal that he sent with pardoning people like Roger Stone and like Paul Manafort, which is that you should break the law for me, and then what I will do is I will protect you. And of course, from his perspective, if some of these people break the law and then it doesn't work out for them, well, you know, it's no skin off his back, right? It's not like he actually cares about these people. So he has threatened this regularly, and we had experience with January 6th, the first non-peaceful transfer of power in modern American history. And so we have already seen him stoke political violence. And you can also add in things like where one of his staunchest supporters attacked an FBI building in response to, tried to shoot up an FBI building and was fortunately stopped. But in response to that was the FBI search warrant in Mar-a-Lago. So it has been working to stoke political violence a lot. And we face that as a serious threat. And any one word he says doesn't really matter, because the overall picture has been one of attacking the rule of law, attacking the Constitution, literally trying to overthrow it with his coup attempt in January 6th, and continuing to stoke political violence afterwards.
Damon, I agree with everything Nicholas has said, and yet I do think that critics made a mistake by focusing in on the bloodbath comment, because it was the weakest of the arguments to make that what Trump did was outrageous over the weekend, and therefore it gave an unnecessary gift to his defenders. What about you?
I agree that that is true. There is something about the dynamic of a rabid populist like Donald Trump that requires the defenders of the rule of law and normal procedures of liberal democracy have to somehow behave even better than normal.
That's
true. They have to demonstrate that they are not subject to the same extreme tendencies toward undermining high principle for the sake of base self-interest. Because the line of Donald Trump and other populists is, nobody has higher motives. Nobody does things for their own sake because it's just the right thing to do. They simply use that as a cover to conceal their own baser self-interested motives. And I, at least, am honest enough to admit that. The others are faking it. So if the other side...
He doesn't say he's honest, though. He never says that.
Well, I think certainly when he was first running, he did say things along those lines that essentially... I'm the one who will tell you the truth about how corrupt everyone is because I'm in there and I'm
That's
corrupt
true.
Too and I know how
he
it
did
works.
That.
I at least will admit it.
Yeah, I guess so. But since then, it's all been about, you know, I'm the martyr here and I am being persecuted on behalf of the great unwashed. But anyway, go on.
Sure, yeah. Sure. I mean, my only point in answering your question of where I come down on this will be to admit that, yes, he has plausible deniability. If you listen to George Wallace's speech at Madison Square Garden before the 1968 election, you will hear Wallace doing exactly the same thing, goading the cops, who are trying to keep order in the mayhem, in the melee of there, and then outside on the street, using everything he can rhetorically to whip the crowd into a frenzy of outrage, but in such a way that he always has plausible deniability that, oh, I didn't say mm-hmm. that they should actually rough that guy up. It was a metaphor.
Yeah.
It was a rally. What do you expect? And Trump does that and has done it, as Nicholas was indicating, all the way back to the beginning, to the early Trump rallies in 2016. He continually inches up to that line, and the way to respond is for the media and others online to have very high exacting standards for themselves. But the last thing I want to add to this is that I also made a point of not jumping in on this online when this whole thing blew up. First, I saw all the tweets about oh, bloodbath, and I thought, oh, this is terrible. And then I didn't say anything about it. Then I watched the video later and heard, well, it's more metaphorical in this context. And I just decided, you know what? I'm not going to attack the media for being irresponsible. I'm not going to attack Trump for inciting some kind of civil war here. This is all the BS. This is the way this is going to play out. It's going to go on for 8 more months. We got to keep our powder dry and just not engage in the nonsense. We've been through this now for so long. I'm not only just exhausted by it, as so many commentators say, but there's a way in which, you know, if you play by the rules of this game, you're somehow brought down by it. Even if you stand on high principle and say the media should do better, yeah, okay, but that's also what Trump wants you to say, you know? Mm. If you enter the fray, then, you know, Godspeed to you. But I really am starting to think that even giving any of this credence is just sort of missing the forest for the trees, to go back to Nick's early metaphor of the forest fire.
Right. Okay, so Bill, you could comment on any of that on the trees, but if you don't have anything other that you want to add to that, I want to ask you about something else.
Well, I want to endorse what Damon just said. That is, my greatest fear for Beg to Differ is that we're going to have to do a version of this segment 32 more times before Election Day. That prospect appalls me, because we know with, as John McLaughlin used to say, metaphysical certainty, that Donald Trump cannot go through a day, let alone a week, without saying something that shocks the conscience, and violates morality, whether Christian, Aristotelian, or natural, right? It's, you know, it's just as certain as that. And, you know, and the more we dissect the outrages of the week, I mean, the more we're playing into his hands in a way, because I don't think we can say anything new about him. I'll put my outrage of the week on the table just to play the game a little bit. You know, when he said that some immigrants aren't people, and then he went on to say, well, you know, the radical left doesn't want you to say that. Well, the Declaration of Independence doesn't want you to say that, for God's sake. Okay, but see, this is what happens every time I go into one of these discussions. So I'm going to stop and let you ask your question.
Okay, I'll just say one more time that I think there are genuine outrages and then there are traps. And I think we fell into a trap this week. I'll just leave it leave it there. But I do want to move on to two people this week who did the unexpected. Those two were Mike Pence and Senator Todd Young of Indiana, who both said that they would not endorse Trump. And that is something that, you know, as my colleague Jonathan Last wrote, that should have been a huge story. That should have been, you know, people should have been lining up outside the doors of these men to talk with them, to hear them amplify this, to talk about how historically unprecedented it is for a vice president to refuse to endorse the man he ran with and served with, et cetera. So, Bill,
yes,
what did you make of it? And do you think that it may provide some sort of encouragement to that segment of Republican Party voters who have expressed their dissatisfaction with Trump by even voting for Nikki Haley when she had already withdrawn, and who are, you know, willing to drag themselves to the polls just to say they don't like Trump? Is this, you know, potentially important, what Pence and Young both did?
It's potentially important if it's a harbinger of a full-throated, you know, nonstop campaign by Republicans, you know, who occupy high office or have occupied high office, and particularly people who occupied high office under Trump, you know, to form a phalanx of naysayers. And you know, if you just say it once, you haven't said it. You say it for 1 week, you haven't said it. You know, there really needs to be an organized campaign. I have to admit that for a long time, Todd Young has been my favorite Republican senator. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with him. You know, he did an admirable job on the CHIPS Act. When I was still with No Labels, he was always in there trying to find an honorable compromise. He is a good man. Well, he would have to be because he's a Marine, but he's a good man. And there is not a mean bone in his body. There's not a destructive bone in his body. If there is a future for the Republican Party, Todd Young and people like Todd Young are that future.
Or should be. Maybe they aren't.
Yeah, but I have to say that given the demographic shift, the profound transformation of the Republican Party under Trump, I think people who want something that isn't Trump, but something that simply doesn't simply harken back to Reagan either. I think it's going to be a long process of reconstruction, much longer than a single presidential cycle.
Linda, let's talk money. You ran for office. You know a little bit about raising money to run for office. And for our younger viewers and listeners, Linda ran for Senate in the state of Maryland. What year was that?
1986.
So Donald Trump is having serious money problems. He has announced that he cannot secure a $454 million bond to cover the fine in his that was assessed in his civil fraud trial. He did come up with the $90 million bond for the sexual abuse case, but he's having troubles. And it isn't just that he has these enormous personal debts, which ought, by the way, ought to worry us because somebody who's that desperate for money seeking high office should set off alarm bells, especially this one. But he is also failing with small donors. Apparently, the Trump team has tapped out their small donors finally, and they are not showing up for him now. And of course, the large donors are worried about giving money to the RNC, which is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump Organization, because they have no confidence the money won't go to pay Trump's legal bills. So if Bill Galston's plan to amplify the comments of people like Todd Young and Mike Pence is to be implemented, they have the money. Might make a difference, possibly, right?
Right. And there are groups like the Republicans Against Trump that are in there trying to play their role. Mona and I know a little bit about this. I do think that money is important. And it is an expression of support. And the fact that he can't get the rubes who are sending him, you know, $5, $10, $25 out of the Social Security checks. And then it turns out he's spending that money not even on his own election, but on paying legal bills. If they've decided, gee, you know, maybe I can use that money on something else and are not giving it to him, that indicates a weakening of support. They will still vote for him. It's true. But it's also true that money does not quite have the same role that it once did, I think, in our politics, because of the proliferation of ways to be able to communicate that don't require as much money through social media and other ways, and, you know, so-called earned media. I think that it's important to note that you can have a lot of money and still not win an election. And the way in which that money is used is terribly important. But it is usually, not always, but usually easier for Republicans to raise money. And the fact that Trump is not doing it, I think, does not bode well for him.
Nick Grossman, any thoughts about Trump's money troubles vis-a-vis either the national security implications or the political implications?
One of the big things that they look for on security clearance applications is, do you owe somebody money? Are you in debt? And the reason why is because approaching people who are in debt and offering to pay their debt is intelligence sorts cultivation 101. And so if the intelligence agencies in Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, you can add UAE, probably Qatar, other people with money to burn, if they have not had a conversation about, can we funnel him some money and buy something with it, whether it's future access, whether it's perhaps some U.S. secrets, you know, either some classified material that he stole and could funnel to them, or just, you know, things he knows that he could tell them, or just buying future influence, that if they have not had a serious conversation about that, they are not doing their jobs. And so I'm very confident that they have talked about that in one way or another. And with Trump in this sort of awkward position of not wanting to sell his buildings in order to get cash because the New York real estate market is not very good and his at the moment. And his entire legal strategy is not to defend himself on the merits because he did all these crimes. You know, he very clearly did commit fraud. If anything, I'd say fraud was central to his business model throughout his entire career. And he very clearly broke a lot of laws when it comes to the classified documents and keeping them, and a lot of laws when trying to overthrow the Constitution. And so he has no legal defense on the merits. And the legal plan has been transparently from the beginning to just delay, run out the clock, become president, say, none of this applies to me, and dare anybody. Like, what are you going to do? Make me, you know, and who's going to make the president go into a courtroom or say, pay some money or something that he doesn't want. But of course, if he has to sell a building, then getting the building back would be hard. So we have this incredibly strange circumstance of a felon who has stoked anti-American violence and risked American security being nominated by the Republican Party for president. And it's incredibly weird, but, you know, that's their choice. And that creates a big national security conundrum. Even another one being that the presidential nominees typically get intelligence briefings. And it's not, you know, as full as, say, the president would get. But this is the first time that we've had a presidential nominee who is an active information security risk. And so that creates additional dilemmas that we wouldn't have to otherwise. But as serious as I do think that is from a national security perspective, I take it as a relative positive that He is under financial pressure, that he's having trouble raising money on the other end, that he is having to devote a lot of his focus into trying to just deal with the legal troubles rather than, say, campaigning or, you know, talking about, I don't know, trade or economics or immigration or things that might actually matter to voters who are still somewhat undecided, rather than, say, just his super fans who vicariously live through him and see it as a, you know, a big psychodrama in which they're cheering on the comeuppance of whoever it is that they don't like by him having victories. So I take that at least as a silver lining.
Bill Galston, Trump posted on Truth Social that this was so unfair. He said that, you know, last year he claimed that he had $500 million in cash right at his disposal. So that's the first part. Second, he doesn't obviously have that amount of cash. And so now he is whining that he may have to sell one of his properties in a fire sale, which is true. I mean, it is true, but it is very hard to shed any tears for him about this when if he didn't do the crime, if he didn't do the fraud, he wouldn't find himself in this unfortunate position. Any comment?
Well, there is a God whose justice, you know, grinds like the mill, exceeding fine, but exceeding slowly.
Slow.
And God has a sense of humor, and so should we all, right? You know, the guy Absolutely. Who lied about the value of his holdings now can't borrow against Yes. them. Perfect.
Amazing.
If I were asked to define divine justice, I really couldn't do any better.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So that's, look, and, you know, and if Schadenfreude is a sin, I've just committed it big time. You know, let me confess.
Yeah.
Let me confess to all of my critics who think I'm a, you know, big, you know, a big moralistic windbag with a stick up as you know you what. I plead guilty. And in my one and only imitation of Donald Trump this year, I feel no shame.
All right. One last thing, Damon, that we should get in here. And that is that, again, something that we could have been focused on more than we did. Trump has let it be known that he is considering bringing Paul Manafort back to be a fundraiser and to be in charge of something or other. Now, that's great. Convicted felon who was the step and fetch it for a Russian intelligence officer who is as corrupt as can be. And yeah, so that is going to be one of Trump's money men.
You know, all I can say is that this is the glimmer of sunshine that I find in that story, which is the number of people who can serve in these key roles for Donald Trump is really small.
That's true.
Like, he can't find anybody but Paul Manafort, who was already known as completely corrupt the first time. And that was before he got sucked up into the Mueller investigation and everything else and had to be pardoned by Trump. I mean, this is a guy who is, he's like the bottom of the barrel that he's still kicking around looking to make a little dough, in these kinds of roles is really astonishing. So we've got him, we got Roger Stone, you know, Steve Bannon's hanging out. It's like
Rogue's
it's
Gallery.
Like the greatest hits of you know, Scumbag of the Year award.
Yep.
And these are the people who are going to be hanging around the White House again if he actually manages to win. So, all right, sure. Yeah, bring Paul Manafort back. You know, bring even more legal scrutiny down on yourself and your campaign and everything else. If that's the best you can do, Don, go right ahead. I'm eager to watch how it all unfolds here.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing that is serious about Manafort is his ties to Russia and to Putin, and the fact that you know, there's a reason why even on the relatively short list of corrupt lackeys who would be helping Trump at the highest levels, you know, Manafort's a guy who has the right connections for someone like Trump, and he's probably very eager to have him back in the fold for that reason.
Precisely. So, yeah, let's just remember that Manafort was working for the Kremlin-linked leader of Ukraine previous to Zelensky, a guy who got thrown out by the Ukrainians exactly because he was Putin's lackey. So great. So that's just wonderful. All right. Let's just have a word from one of our sponsors, and then we will turn to our next topic. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. They also provide pancakes, smoothies, and more. There's a wide variety of easy options for every meal of the day. There's no prep, no mess meals. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, and so it's very easy, no cleanup. My husband has been grabbing these and taking them to work. He pops them in the microwave and says they are delicious. So that is a personal endorsement from a picky eater. Actually, he's not that picky. But anyway, he really liked them. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. So head to factormeals.com/begtodiffer50. And use the code BEGTODIFFER50 to get 50% off. That's code BEGTODIFFER50 at factormeals.com/BEGTODIFFER50 to get 50% off. We thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, let's turn now to what is happening with Israel and Gaza. We had the majority leader, Senator Schumer, give a speech about Israel's leadership. And it was a very careful speech, I would say, but he did recommend that Israelis vote for new leadership. So obviously that's been very controversial. And we've also seen Netanyahu address the Republicans in a closed door session, Republican senators, but not Democratic senators. And arguably, Nick Grossman, this repeats a bad pattern with Netanyahu, where he has been willing to kind of play U.S. politics very aggressively and try to make it, you know, Republicans are for Israel and Democrats are not, which is a dangerous thing, it seems to me, for an Israeli leader to do, considering that he does have many friends on the Democratic side of the aisle, and he needs friends on the Democratic side. What do you think?
So I think that's right, and that Netanyahu in particular made a very serious strategic mistake about at this point, about I think 11, 12 years ago, when he accepted a Republican, so it was a congressional Republican invitation that went around the White House to basically go and address Congress and say why U.S. foreign policy was bad.
This was when Obama was president.
When Obama was president, right, and it was over the Iran deal. Certainly, you know, makes sense for Israel and its leadership to have opinions about any sort of, you know, certainly something as high profile as Iranian nuclear program and U.S. diplomacy with Iran, of him expressing that would have been fine. Going around the White House explicitly and giving a partisan speech to Congress was something I remember thinking at the time, that this was just a really bad, unnecessary error, in that Israel's security has, for this point, decades been supported both in terms of things diplomatically internationally, like, say, vetoes of anti-Israel resolutions at the United Nations, and with military cooperation, with direct aid, all those things, has largely been a bipartisan thing inside the United States. And Netanyahu's not the only factor that has made it increasingly more partisan, but he has contributed to that significantly. And for things like, not only had expressed his opinion, kind of directly participated within a U.S. political frame, not just commenting from afar, but he also had staked, you know, so much of his his prime ministership on his ability to provide security, and that with, you know, October 7th failed as egregiously as probably any leader has failed at any point, especially any leader in Israel's history, especially given that they had warnings from Egyptian intelligence and disregarded them and instead stayed focused on things in the West Bank as opposed to worrying about Gaza. And then the conduct of the war that does not seem to have a clear plan after, has had loose rules of engagement that have resulted in more humanitarian suffering, more civilian death than would be necessary, even in looking at as the war effort itself being justified by October 7th and Hamas's attacks. So all of this combined, I thought that Schumer's speech was quite good, and that he is right in that the Netanyahu specifically and his far-right coalition has been bad for Israel and is continuing to be bad, and makes it a lot harder for the United States to continue supporting them, including by Netanyahu's efforts to play partisan politics in the U.S. And that with especially looking at younger generations being more negative about Israel and more critical of it, that over time, this is getting worse and worse for them. And in many ways, he doesn't really have anybody but himself to blame. So at least he has many contributions that he could have avoided. And that the idea of saying a country that is actively providing you with billions of dollars in military aid can't comment on your domestic politics when you have been commenting on our domestic politics is just, on top of everything else, obnoxious. And he's wrong.
Yeah. Linda, there are reasons that distributing humanitarian aid has been challenging. One of the problems is that Israeli soldiers are afraid of putting their own lives at risk in distributing aid. They're afraid of being kidnapped if they are, you know, unguarded and in charge of distributing aid. On the other hand, Netanyahu has to realize that images of starving Palestinians that are filling the screens of people all over the world are unsustainable in terms of Israel's global reputation. And I feel that he has not risen to the occasion. You know, one of the things that he could do, for example, instead of barking at people for interfering in their domestic affairs, he could have put out a call for international assistance in providing humanitarian aid, right? He could have said, look, our soldiers, for understandable reasons and good reasons, don't want to be, you know, in the line of fire here, but, you know, we would welcome Saudis, UAE, whatever, you know, other people to come, Indians, whoever, to come and help set up aid centers. What do you think?
I think that what is going on in Gaza now is heartrending. There are children who cannot, you know, get enough food, who are being killed in military operations. I don't question that Israel has the right to go in and root out Hamas. And as I've said many times on this show, it could end tomorrow if Hamas would simply declare that they are, you know, going to give up. And they're not doing that.
And release the hostages.
And they use civilians as a human shield. And they have always used civilians. There was one raid, I believe, into Al-Shifa, the hospital in northern Gaza, where, again, top Hamas official was, in fact, Israel, in order to get him, went in and he was killed. But, you know, that aside, I do think that it would be helpful if Biden was able to persuade Netanyahu to try to set up some third party that would help in the distribution of aid. But I can also understand why Netanyahu might be suspicious of the Saudis and others going in, and, you know, what that would do in terms of the future. But I do want to respond back to what Nicholas said, and that is, I think Schumer was wrong to give the speech that he gave. The fact that Netanyahu has behaved badly in the past is not an excuse for Schumer to do it. I think it's very dangerous when, particularly when an ally of ours is at war, to go out and to give a speech, essentially calling for that person to be ousted, which is, you know, he didn't say that precisely. He wanted elections after hostilities cease, but the idea was that it would replace the current government. That's not something you do. And I think it was unfortunate. I think what it does is it makes the split between Democrats and Republicans on support for Israel brought into greater relief. And I think Bill could say a lot more about this than I can. But polling shows that Israel is losing support more rapidly among Democrats and independents. There have been several polls more recently. Now, you know, that's also because the Democratic Party has a left-wing element that is going to be hostile to Israel. But I think it was a mistake. I think now Netanyahu is going to be invited to give a speech to a joint session of Congress. Schumer has already said that he would not oppose that. That's the kind of thing you do for allies, and let him make his case, not in a partisan way, but before the public. And don't us get involved in telling when Israelis should or should not remove a democratically elected. I mean, we can do that as pundits. I'd like to see Bibi gone tomorrow, but that's a very different thing than the top Democrat in the Senate saying it.
Okay. Nick, you wanted to respond briefly?
Yes, thanks. So I agree with that as a the normal way to do things. I think you're right, and that what, Schumer doing it was a sign of how incredibly frustrating the normal way of doing things has been, how much the current Israeli government has thwarted various American efforts in the process. And I don't mean things of telling them, for example, to, I don't know, just give up and leave Hamas in charge. You know, nothing like that. The Biden administration certainly hasn't done that. But taking it as, for example, rejecting or not going along with America's push to try to have a plan for what's going to come after. And, you know, especially we can tell you the United States, look, we went through this whole thing with Iraq. You really, really need a plan for after you remove people from power if you're trying to then, so in this case, they dislodge Hamas from power in the way that the U.S. might have moved either Taliban or Saddam Hussein from power, that you need this plan afterwards. You need to, in terms of long-term security, be able to all this diplomatic effort the U.S. is putting on behalf to try to get detente between Israel and Saudi Arabia. You have to give them something. You got to be able to at least show them that you're kind of moving in a direction to try perhaps in the future for a Palestinian state, just a little, and they won't do that. And things like blocking aids. We're seeing this absurdity of the U.S. doing a, you know, almost like Berlin Airlift style humanitarian aid delivery to a place that is not controlled by an enemy, surrounded by an enemy like the Soviet Union, but controlled by one of America's close international partners. And that what Schumer's speech reflected. So, I mean, I would almost always I would have agreed with that, but that reflected this, you know, just being fed up and kind of frustration of trying that normal way of doing business over and over again, and it not yielding success. And that in particular, Israel should take very seriously that Chuck Schumer, of all people, that a, you know, staunch supporter of Israel, of somebody who a prominent Jewish American, of somebody who is openly about it, of, you know, where even in all the inflection on things like I'm Jewish. I grew up in New York. I, you know, appreciate it's like very much a New York Jew. And I get, you know, I like feel represented in that way, whether I agree with him or not, but in Congress. And so he is exactly the sort of diaspora Jew that would be in general supportive and has been supportive of Israel so much. And for him, of all people, to stop doing the normal way of business, to be so fed up with it that he would say this, should be a sign to Israel that they may not really be open-eyed about how much they're alienating people, even people that really want to support them, like Schumer does.
Bill Galston, you had a column about this, all of this week. And so reprise, if you would, the points you made there, but then also respond, if you would, on the matter of getting humanitarian aid to Gaza.
Well, let me start with humanitarian aid to Gaza. There is an organization whose job it is to do just that. I understand Israel's problems with the United Nations, you know, refugee agency. You know, Netanyahu has succeeded in poisoning the minds of Congress to such an extent that it's my understanding that the budget is going to forbid any U.S. money from going through UNRWA. But I am deeply skeptical that the UAE, the Saudis, the Moroccans, anyone else are going to come in and be seen to be doing the bidding of the United States or Israel or pulling their chestnuts out of the fire. I mean, Nick may have a more informed view on the issue, but I just think that's castles in the air. And at the end of the day, to associate myself with some previous remarks, Israel cannot be seen to be presiding over the starving of children. I'm sorry, right? There's some things that just go beyond geopolitics. And, you know, I'm as staunch as Schumer, but at the end of the day, not only is that just the wrong thing to do, but if you're trying to convince the rest of the world, you know, that you're not playing on the same field, that's a pretty good way to do it. So I suspect that the solution will not be jerry-built. It will not be some, you know, pickup team from the Middle East. I think ultimately the organization that already exists is going to have to be a vital part of the solution. That means a lot of people are going to have to climb down off a lot of high trees. With regard to Schumer's speech, I mean, I pointed out in my piece that he has two audiences. He understands one of those audiences, the American Jewish audience and the Democratic Party, to a fairly well. But when it comes to Israel, he's stuck in the past. He somehow thinks that Netanyahu's policies in Gaza are unacceptably to the right of Israeli public opinion. I've reluctantly come to the conclusion that I know more about Israeli public opinion than Schumer or his staff people do, because I can tell you they don't want Netanyahu to stay in office, but they do not object to what he's doing in Gaza, not any of it, right? And 85% of the Israeli people, at least the Jews, the Jewish Israelis, want the IDF to go into Rafah and finish the job. It's as simple as that. And remarkably, and I say this with no pride in my own people, about two-thirds of Israelis are indifferent to the question of whether humanitarian aid gets delivered to Gaza. But these are facts about where Jewish Israelis have been driven as a result of the attack of October 7th, which I think was a shattering experience psychologically. We're not just talking about geopolitics here. We're talking about a traumatized people that was convinced first by the left in the last two decades of the 20th century and then by the right in the first two decades of the 21st century that either the left or the right had a formula for the security of the Jewish people in Israel. And it turns out that both of those formulae were wrong. People don't know where to turn now. But the first thing they want is a baseline of security that they believe can only be achieved through the destruction of Hamas. Not every last member of Hamas, but certainly the destruction of Hamas as a possible governing force in Gaza. And so Schumer's speech, I can report with absolute certainty, has fallen on completely deaf ears among the Israeli people, let alone the Netanyahu government.
Damon, It is deeply, deeply tragic. I agree 100% with what Bill just said about the views within Israel. They are completely traumatized as a nation, and there is support for finishing the job. They also don't get, in their news, this is a common problem all over the world, but they don't get the level of news about what's actually happening on the ground to Palestinians in Gaza that we're getting. It's downplayed a little bit there. But But here's the thing. This is a real failure of leadership by Netanyahu, I would submit, because leaders, good leaders, don't just, you know, like Pavlov's dogs, do what makes, you know, what public opinion demands. I mean, George W. Bush, I know I'm going to cite somebody who I know is not your favorite, Damon, but this aspect of his leadership, I think you would agree, was good, which is, you know, after 9/11, when there was bloodlust in this country against Muslims, George W. Bush did the right thing as a leader in deflecting that and emphasizing that our fight was not with the Muslim world and certainly not with individual Muslims. And he went to a mosque and he said, religion, you know, Islam is a religion of peace, which a lot of people thought was maybe not quite right. No, but anyway, you get my point. He did the right thing as a leader. And Netanyahu, it seems to me, is not. He is, first of all, he's only in power because of these radical right-wing people that he has brought in, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who say horrible things about basically driving the Palestinians out of Gaza altogether. They don't talk about mass murder, but they do talk about, you know, ethnic cleansing, you know, or driving them out. I mean, it's just horrifying. And Netanyahu has not been willing to go against them because that would mean losing power. And if he loses power, he goes to jail. So, I mean, the whole thing is just a huge, well, I won't use a bad word, but what a mess.
Yeah, I don't exactly hear a question.
I know.
I'll respond thematically or
okay,
mood-wise to the vibe.
The Israelis have a word for this. It's balagan.
Balagan, yeah.
Well, look, I mean, let me actually back up a little bit to the conversation everyone else has been having, just so I can weigh in a little bit on the Schumer speech, and I'll tie it to Netanyahu and what he's doing. My take is actually maybe the most cynical of the takes here, as my takes sometimes are. I think Schumer's speech was entirely about base maintenance for the Democratic Party in this country. So much so that given Schumer's very long track record of staunch support for Israel and close ties to Israeli government officials and so forth, this is decades of relationships here. I would be shocked if he had not given a call to Benjamin Netanyahu before his speech and warned him about it and said, look, I am covering bases here for my party. Biden is supporting you as much as he can manage. It's hurting us as we head into re-election with the left wing of our party. We're in danger in certain states like Michigan because of it, because of the Muslim population there that is not on our side. And I have to do a little lifting here to try to hit back. And how can he do it? He can do it by hitting Netanyahu. Now, I am 125% with Bill on Israeli public opinion. I defer to him on public opinion on almost everything, but I know for a fact myself by studying it that that is where Israeli public opinion is. And I find it inconceivable that Schumer himself does not know that. He knows that every plausible successor to Netanyahu agrees 100% with Netanyahu's policy in Gaza, and that it will make no difference. It therefore is completely non sequitur to posit that he thinks, if, first of all, that if he says mean things about Netanyahu, that that will actually contribute to him leaving power? No, he's a smart guy and he understands dynamics that actually it's possible it's going to get the Israeli voters' backs up and they're going to actually maybe rally around him a little bit, and that therefore could help Netanyahu a little for a week or something. And he also understands that like saying that we need to get rid of Netanyahu to kind of make the war go a little nicer, he knows that that also isn't accurate. And so I therefore conclude that I think this was purely about, let me throw some some crumbs toward the left, as much as I, Chuck Schumer, staunch Israel supporter, can do, and that's say some critical things about Netanyahu. So now, but back to Netanyahu himself. Nick is saying we have a little chat going here as we do the show, and Nick points out that Bibi would prefer Trump and the Republicans. So that's fine. Sure, he would like that for reasons that don't entirely make sense to me. I mean, I get it, but Trump is so irrational. So Trump would throw Israel under the bus if he could get a big fat loan from Vladimir Putin or for any number of other reasons. So, but yes, ideologically speaking, he's with the Republicans. He wants the Republicans in power to be his allies in Washington, even though the Democrat Joe Biden has done more than any president ever has to help. But, in the end, as others have said, Netanyahu wants to hold on to power because if he loses power, he's likely going to go to jail. His career is over. He'll lose in a probably a very big landslide, and it'll be an ignominious end to a very long storied career in Israeli politics. And as I think Bill has pointed out in some of our little chats here, it is also the case that if that were to happen, to avoid that happening, it just so happens that it perfectly aligns with what Israeli public opinion wants to happen, which is for the war to continue, and he's in power and prosecuting it. So for now, for still, for these past 5 months, and for a little while longer, it seems, we move forward, and he remains in power. He stays out of jail and keeps fighting the war pretty much every Israeli wants to be waged.
Okay, thank you for that. I would just point out that the Israeli army, from what I understand, has learned a lot about how to fight Hamas in the last 5 months and how to reduce the number of civilian casualties. So the assault on Rafah, when it comes, may not be quite as devastating as what we saw in the north. On the other hand, that doesn't mitigate the problem of, widespread food insecurity and even starvation in some instances. So, all right. Well, thank you. We will move on now to our final segment. But first, let's hear a word from Miracle Made. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Using silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA, Miracle-Made sheets are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature. They are self-cleaning, which is fantastic, and they retard 99.7% of bacterial growth, letting them stay cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than other sheets. Miracle sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands, and they feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer and use the code BEGTODIFFER to claim a free 3-piece towel set and save 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to treat yourself. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right. We now come to our highlight or lowlight of the week, and we will start with Bill Galston.
Well, first of all, I think we need to think bigger, beg to differ. I think we need a beg to differ discount card that covers more than sheets. Just a suggestion to your back office. But moving right along, this will shock my closest friends particularly. But I actually have what I think may be some good news in the offing. And that is, for the first time in 6 months, I am beginning to see the glimmering of a deal that could deliver aid to Ukraine. And I think, strange to say, the deal is rooted in a suggestion that Donald Trump made. He basically said no to a grant, you know, grant of outright money to Ukraine, but he's on board with apparently a loan. And he sort of shrugged and said, well, if Ukraine doesn't make it, I guess we won't get our money back. But if that's good enough for Trump, that's good enough for me. You know, and if they want to wrap it in the, you know, in the gauzy label of Lend-Lease from World War II, that's fine with me too, right? And I am beginning to detect signs that it's that idea is gaining momentum in the House of Representatives. They don't think that they will incur Trump's wrath if they vote for a loan. I mean, Lindsey Graham on the Senate side has already made it very clear that the loan would be a zero interest loan and, as he put it, eminently forgivable. And so it's a grant that dare not speak its name. I don't care. I just want the Ukrainians to get the weapons. So, you know, I've been a voice of gloom. I didn't think there was a way forward, but if Donald Trump has given the Republican Party a way forward, who am I to resist?
Thank you. Linda Chavez.
Well, Bill just made my week. That's great news. I have a little bit of good news followed by some bad news for our audience. The good news is that in the agreement to essentially fund the government, the spending bill that would fund the government, keep us out of having to shut down, there was an agreement to increase the number of special immigrant visas available to Afghans. Now, these are visas that are given to people who actually helped the United States in the war in Afghanistan. And there are only 12,000 included. The advocates who were pushing for this wanted 20,000, but they did get 12, and it's at least a step in the right direction. So that's a little bit of good news that I wanted to share. But the bigger story is the bad news at the Texas border. And I'm not talking about people flooding into the United States. I'm talking about the state of Texas, which is challenging the federal government for its role in governing immigration policy. There was a bill passed called SB4, which basically made Texas capable of not only arresting undocumented people in the state, but essentially being able to deport them, even ignoring other immigration court proceedings that might be going on. A federal judge at the lower level said that he was going to put that on hold. And while it is being appealed, it went to the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to weigh in, rather than following 150 years of precedent on this issue, which gives the federal government the role in immigration, not states individually. They decided to kick it back down to the appeals court. That case was heard this week. We don't know how it's going to turn out. But, you know, we've been down this path before. And that 1875 case that I referred back to was the state of California, which tried to keep Chinese from coming into the state of California at that point. This was before the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the Supreme Court in 1875 was unequivocal and mentioned the fact that if you had individual states making this decision on their own, that you could essentially end up provoking wars, certainly disrupting foreign policy. I'd like to see what Texas would think if California suddenly decided that it was going to not just be a sanctuary, but essentially tried to overrule federal law and grant, the right to stay in California to citizens. This is a disaster. It's got to be settled, and it has to be settled following the 150-year precedent of Chai Lung versus Freeman.
Thank you. Nicholas Grossman.
So just really briefly, just about what Bill said, and then I'll give you mine, but which is that I very much share his sentiment on the importance of supporting Ukraine. I think the fact that the U.S. has been so delayed in this is both a strategic and moral failure, and one that is easy to avoid, that we're doing to ourselves, and it is very consequential. So I would absolutely love if aid could get through. I am unfortunately more skeptical about, say, this specific loan agreement. It sounds to me more like, you know, it's too cute. It's the sort of thing that Lindsey Graham did multiple times during the Trump presidency, in which Graham would advocate, you know, national security or maybe some sort of old school Reaganite foreign policy. Trump would be opposed. Graham would come up with some gimmick and tell everybody, hey, I think I found a way to pitch it to Trump. And people would get maybe a little optimistic for a day or two. And then, you know, Trump might say something, sure, okay, and then, you know, not do it or not buy it. So I hope that I'm wrong in that Trump and in general MAGA's fundamental attitude towards the Ukraine war is that they would like to see Russia succeed and that the rest of it is basically irrelevant. They're just coming up with ways to rationalize that one way or the other. But I hope on this that I'm wrong and you were right. Then my highlight for the week is to talk about the possible TikTok ban, or I guess a forced divestment the House just passed. I'm someone who I'm torn about this. I wasn't totally sure about what I thought about where one is. It goes against my maybe more kind of libertarian free speech, free enterprise instinct that, you know, this is not the sort of thing government should do and is opening up a can of worms. On the other hand, there is a kind of national security instinct on these social networks are powerful, even if we don't totally understand them, and that having such a powerful tool in the hands of a rival government, and of course, the company that owns TikTok answers to the Chinese government, as all major Chinese companies do, and that that is concerning. But I think I was persuaded most by an article, and I'll give the link to everybody, but an article in a blog called Tech Dirt by the tech writer Mike Masnick. And if you don't know him, he's a prolific tech writer and is probably most famous in internet world for coining the term the Streisand effect.
Oh.
About when, you know, people try to, in particular Barbara Streisand, but try to get some material taken down and as a result attract much more attention to it and get a lot of people to see it. But he put up an argument that said, so there are essentially two arguments, kind of accusations against TikTok. One is that it is a data mining operation and that China could potentially gain something from that. And one is the potential to push out propaganda. And on the data mining one, he makes a very convincing argument that this is basically irrelevant, that if we actually cared about any of these data issues, that we would do general data privacy laws, that China can access information from people through all sorts of shady data brokers, that they can get, you know, tons of information online about Americans. They don't really need TikTok for that. Previously, Chinese hackers have gotten into, pretty sure, you know, meaning you can never totally accuse them, but the U.S. has totally proved, say, where it came from, but the U.S. is accused of it, of getting into the Office of Personnel Management, which means that they got their hands on like 20 million social security numbers, and not to mention things like security clearance applications, and that's a lot of potential blackmail material and all this other stuff. So in terms of data mining, they do tons of that, and so do, you know, every other social media, so do, you know, Facebook and Google and the rest of them, and that alone, say, would not be a good reason they're not taking it seriously. And on the propaganda one, I think makes a pretty good argument that also it is limited in this particular ability, that it's not really something that we understand, that they can do it via other channels. Just as one example, if we've seen Russian intelligence do a bunch of influence operations and propaganda via networks that they don't own, and that overall, I think kind of persuaded me that this is the bill that they did pass would not address any of the issues really that it claims to address and would open up a can of worms that has all sorts of implications for the First Amendment and free enterprise going forward. So I was pretty convinced that at least the way they're doing it here is not a bad idea. Although I have to admit that national security part of my brain still says if what ends up happening is a bunch of Americans own TikTok, yeah, that's not so bad. Although then I saw that one of the people putting together a package to try to buy it, a team to try to buy it, is Steve Mnuchin, the former Trump secretary of the Treasury. And If you ask me if there was, if we assume, say, that TikTok is a powerful, potentially influence operation propaganda network, if the Chinese government has that and is, you know, kind of influencing, especially influencing the youth, or if a couple of, like, far right rich guys have that and are using that to influence the youth and the public, I don't know if that's necessarily better. Both of those seem bad.
Well, we already do have a far right influencer controlling Twitter, right. X. So we know what that's like. The national security thing, though, it does disturb me about the Chinese ownership of TikTok. My understanding is they've already used it to elevate, for example, pro-Palestinian messaging on their site and downplaying Israel's side of the story. They suppress things about Tiananmen and about, you know, religious liberty in China, things like that. And you can easily imagine that if they one fine day decide that they're going to invade Taiwan, they would also be blasting out on TikTok all kinds of justifications for it. And some huge percentage of Americans under the age of 35 get a lot of their news from TikTok. So we may have to put up with Elon Musk because he's an American citizen, but we don't have to put up with the foreign ownership by a hostile government of TikTok. That's the pushback, I would say. So, okay, Damon Linker.
I just can't resist, before I get to my highlight or lowlight, putting in my two cents to say that I think this is a no-brainer than the whole TikTok thing. Like, on national security grounds, there is absolutely no way that we should be permitting the Chinese government to have a direct propaganda line into the pockets of 100 million Americans. I mean, it is crazy to even really tie ourselves in knots about it. I really do think it's clear and obvious that this can't be. And I'll take 100 Steve Mnuchin to Steve Mnuchin ownership of social media companies over the Chinese Communist Party, especially, as Mona says, if they decide they're going to take Taiwan and then, you know, we have them manipulating public opinion within our country that will affect how we respond. It's intolerable. That's my view, at least. But I was never much of a libertarian. So my highlight or low light. I don't know whether it's a highlight or low light. I guess I will say it's a highlight because anytime you discover beautiful writing that moves you and touches you deep down inside, that's a highlight. This is an essay that the author David Frum, who is probably known to all of our listeners, he's been on the podcast as a guest many times. Many of us here, not myself so much, but I think many of the people on the podcast consider him a close personal friend. If you haven't heard, his 32-year-old daughter, Miranda, died suddenly, unexpectedly, in mid-February. And he has now published an essay in The Atlantic about it titled Miranda's Last Gift. The gift is an adorable little dog, and you have to read the essay to find out how and why this dog is the gift, and the dog's role in the really just wrenching story of Miranda's death and how David and his wife, Danielle Crittenden, have been responding to it and coping with the unspeakable grief of her loss. So again, for the sake of great writing and humanistic empathy, I very strongly recommend this essay. I hope everyone reads it with a box of tissues nearby.
Thank you, Damon. David and Danielle are dear friends of mine, and I watched Miranda grow up. And it's just been wrenching. So highly recommend the essay. Well, it's in the essay, but just so people understand, she had a brain tumor 5 years ago and survived the surgery, but there were consequences of removing her pituitary gland that in the end caused her to succumb to an illness. So really devastating. All right. I would like to draw attention to a poll of a happiness measure. Every year, you know, they publish these studies asking which country is the happiest. And every year it's either Finland or Denmark or one of the Baltic nations. And this year, again, it was Finland. But what was notable was that the United States has dropped out of the top 20. And this fall was precipitated by the fact that young people in the United States are getting less and less satisfied with their lives. And it is something that bears paying attention to, I think. I mean, it's easy to make fun of these surveys, and maybe, you know, it's important not to take any one survey as gospel. But we also have a lot of other evidence that people are feeling more and more lonely, that young people, for example, are spending less time hanging out with their friends. High school students are spending much less time hanging out with their friends than they used to 20 or 30 years ago. They're spending a lot more time with screens on social media, which is not a good substitute, and in some cases actually makes things much worse. And then I want to make one other point about young people and mental health. This is a huge subject, but and I don't mean for this at all to be, you know, dispositive, but it is worth mentioning that one thing that keeps coming up when you read about young people and their worries is climate change. And it's right and good to be concerned about the climate. It is a huge problem that humanity has to cope with. But there is a catastrophism that has taken hold among a lot of young people who will tell pollsters that they don't think they should even get married and start families because their kids will not be able to survive in the overheated world that they think is right around the corner. And, you know, even the most, you know, fervent climate activists recognize that this is an exaggeration of the danger that is faced. And so it is important to get a little bit more of a reality check on that. You know, it is a huge problem. We've solved huge problems in the past. But in any event, it isn't an existential crisis. It doesn't mean that the human race is going to be extinct in 30 years, which apparently is a widespread view and is depressing young people. So I hope that there will be a little bit of a correction on that, and that kids will also, you know, get off their screens and start shooting baskets or hanging out more.
You know, I'm glad you brought the happiness survey up, because it's a very credible piece of social science that's been going on for quite some time, so we can actually see trends. What jumped out at me about that survey is that the elderly in America rank as 10th in the world on this happiness scale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Young adults under the age of 30 are 62nd, right? And You might think that if you're old, you're more likely, your spouse may have died, you know, you're supposed to be more isolated and lonely. If you're young, you're healthy, the world is spread out before you. But boy, it's just the opposite. We really ought to think about this.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, thanks for that. And I want to thank our guest, Nick Grossman. Thank you so much for joining us again. And I want to thank our regular panel, as well as our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary. And then, of course, our wonderful listeners and viewers on YouTube. Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.